Council, we're going to proceed. We were expecting about 30 students in for the argument, but they haven't arrived. I tell you that because if you hear the doors open and a lot of footsteps, that's what it is. We'll just continue, okay? I'll call 08-AP-1185-CR, State versus Michael Carter. Aaron O'Neill, Assistant Attorney General for the State of Wisconsin, arguing on behalf of the state. Mr. O'Neill.
Thank you, Chief Justice, and may it please the court. The state is asking that this court reverse the Court of Appeals decision, remanding this case to the Circuit Court for further proceedings on Mr. Carter's claim that his trial counsel was ineffective for failures relating to investigating and presenting evidence that the victim in this case had been previously sexually assaulted by another person. The Court of Appeals remanded for further proceedings on this claim, holding that Mr. Carter's trial counsel had performed efficiently for failing to fully investigate the existence and details of the prior assault and its potential admissibility. And the court also then concluded that until that investigation was completed, it was not possible for that court or the circuit court to determine whether Mr. Carter was prejudiced by his counsel's actions within the meaning of Strickland versus Washington. The state challenges the Court of Appeals decision on two grounds, although there is some relation between the two of them. The first is that the Court of Appeals decision ignores that Mr. Carter already had an opportunity to show the investigation that his trial counsel should have conducted. That time was during the original post-conviction proceedings as part of his filed a post-conviction motion, and there was an evidentiary hearing. And time for Mr. Carter to show what his trial counsel should have done in that investigation was at that time as part of his motion and then subsequently at the hearing. In this hearing, the circuit court found that Mr. Carter had failed to prove his claim, and a decision that the state believes is fully supported by the transcripts, or excuse me, the record of what transpired during the post-conviction proceedings. The Court of Appeals...
O'Neill, did the circuit court make a finding in regard to prejudice?
The circuit court's finding of prejudice is not entirely clear. There are some hints, I think, in its decision, although it didn't, clearly go through the Strickland prongs and say, I'm not finding deficient performance, I'm not finding prejudice. There are some findings, I think the court states, for example, that it's a stretch to conclude based on the victim's statements or what Mr. Carter has alleged that the evidence of the prior assault would have been admissible pursuant to the Polizzano test, and I think that's an implicit finding that there's, no prejudice.
Counsel, is it your position then that the circuit court did make a finding of no prejudice?
I don't believe that the court explicitly found that there was no prejudice. I don't see that in the court's decision.
Well, let's take a look at Petitioner's Appendix 199. 198, the very bottom, the court's talking about strategy, and top of 199, I think it's the court that says, I don't believe that you can find either prong, that either prong was proven. But more importantly, on Petitioner Appendix 207, then the court says, coming back to prejudice, I think even had counsel done a Polizzano motion, had he been successful, had he admitted it, it would have been rebutted by the state. I think we would have somebody who's facing a charge of sexual assault of a child trying to blame this victim and blaming a five-year-old child. I think that this is not a strategy that is a winning strategy. Maybe it is in some cases, blah, 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 blah. I'm just editorializing on the blah, blah, blah. That's not there. And then at the very bottom, it says, when we look at prejudice, we have a five-year-old. And so the court did talk about prejudice, and I guess the court, I don't know if I'm going to find an exact quote that says, I, comma, the court, comma, hereby find that there's no prejudice, but I certainly interpreted what I read and a few other references to prejudice in that transcript as the court addressing the issue of prejudice and thinking that there was none. Now, maybe I'm wrong, so help me on that.
Well, then I guess I stand corrected. The court did address prejudice. Perhaps it didn't clearly go through prejudice in the way I addressed it in my brief.
don't agree with me if I'm wrong. I mean, you know, I read you.
I think what some of what you read addresses deficient performance as well, talking about the strategy. And I think that the court, though, you're correct in that saying that it's looking at, it's towards the end of the page, I think 205, it is talking about the effect that this would have had, had this, I assume, you have to assume that the court's saying it had been admitted, what effect it would have had on the outcome of the trial, which is the prejudice determination.
Well, he seems to think that the evidence would have come in regardless of Polizano, and that the state would have lost if there had been an objection. He says that on the top of page 208. So that would lead you to believe that state argues it wouldn't have been able to come in. So the court seems to say it would have been able to come in. Then the court said, so that would raise a question about competence. Then he says it was a reasonable, rational decision based on the facts and the law to not raise it. So now we're back to competence, and the final result is not. Mm-hmm. How did we test whether there was prejudice or not? Does the appellate court decide for itself as a matter of law?
I think the appellate court can determine prejudice as a matter of law based on the findings of fact and what happened at the post-conviction proceedings. I think they can look at what happened, what the defendant proved, and applying that, even under perhaps the, you know, the best case scenario, as we do often in a where a post-conviction motion has been denied without a hearing, we look at the allegations in the motion and we assume they're true. Or I don't do it, the appellate courts do it, but assuming that the allegations are true, does that establish that there's a reasonable probability of a different result?
What about the language on page 206? This is still the court. This is a very long statement by the court. I hope I got it right, that it's still the court.
Yes.
I don't think there is any criticism for not bringing the motion. Before that, he says, I think the counsel had a reasonable basis for the strategy. I don't think there's any criticism for not bringing the motion. I think the strategy was a reasonable one, and I'm also satisfied there has been no prejudice that was established. Is that a finding?
It's a conclusion.
Pardon me?
It's a conclusion, yes.
Yeah, well, no prejudice was established. That's what the circuit court concluded?
Yes.
Okay.
And if there is finding that no prejudice was established, the Court of Appeals was obligated to look for reasons to confirm that decision by examining the record and looking for rationale, even if the circuit court didn't provide a rationale that would sustain its decision.
So that's why you're objecting to the remand?
Well, there are two reasons, as I said. One is that the Court of Appeals concluded that there was trial counsel should have conducted an investigation into the circumstances of what happened at this prior incident. And our objection to on that ground is, the Court of Appeals said that until that investigation is completed, they can't determine prejudice, and the circuit court couldn't determine prejudice. Our objection to that conclusion is that that investigation should have been done before the case went to the Court of Appeal. It should have been done in the circuit court. When a defendant claims that his trial counsel is ineffective for conducting an investigation, it's the defendant's obligation, when making that claim, to conduct that investigation and present whatever conclusions or whatever evidence comes forward during that investigation to the circuit court. And our position is that didn't happen here. All we have, I think, to support the defendant's claim is his offer of proof in his post-conviction motion and his testimony, and then a videotape that is not in the record of an interview with the victim performed by during the investigation into the defendant's crime.
Counsel, you've said now twice that you have two reasons why the Court of Appeals is wrong in remanding.
Mm-hmm.
And I get the first one. Essentially, you're saying he already had an opportunity for investigation. What's the second
one? The second one is that he did not prove, the defendant did not prove that the evidence was admissible pursuant to the Polizano exception to the rape shield law. And it, again, I'll get into that in a second, but that sort of blends in with my previous ground for attacking the Court of Appeals decision. I think it's, in order to prove that his trial counsel was ineffective, the defendant has the obligation of showing that the evidence he wanted to introduce was in fact admissible at trial. And it's the state's position that the defendant failed to make that showing with respect to all the Polizano prongs, although I think the first two are the most important ones to look at and the easiest to resolve the claim on.
How do you analyze the Polizano issue for us?
Do I?
Yeah. Can you explain it to me? What's your strongest argument that this doesn't come in under Polizano?
It's related to the first argument that I've already been making, is that the defendant did not show that the prior incident clearly occurred. There is scant evidence in the record to show that whatever this prior incident was, the circumstances of what it was, or even that it clearly occurred, we have, like I said, the defendant's testimony at the post-conviction hearing and his offer of proof. The circuit court found his testimony not credible based on a variance between his offer of proof and his testimony about whether law enforcement ever became involved in an investigation of the previous incident.
But the police officer's own testimony showed that she had knowledge of what he was asking her to do before he asked her to do it. And that knowledge was aside from the incident that was the subject matter. So already in the record, there's indication that, intimation that she has, for a 5 to 6 year old, more sophisticated knowledge about sex than one would expect, and that it had to come from somewhere, and at least the officer didn't know where, but he knew that she knew it from something. So, I mean,
you're referring to at trial,
yes,
the testimony of the police officer. That is, you know, correct. The officer testified that the victim said she knew what the defendant wanted, but the victim couldn't explain why she knew that. But that doesn't make the evidence of the prior incident here admissible because it doesn't involve the same act, even if you believe the defendant's way it's considered.
Doesn't involve oral sex or...
No, the previous incident does not involve oral sex.
Okay, what does it involve?
It involves touching of the...
All right.
Cousins.
Hand instead of mouth.
Hand instead of mouth, correct.
Right. That's not close enough?
The case law makes it pretty clear that it's not close enough.
Depends on what you're trying to prove, but if you're trying to prove knowledge of what penis is, what semen is, what an ejaculation is, what an erection is, not close enough?
I think that the argument is there that it is close enough, but if you look at the reasons why we have this narrow exception to the rape shield law and this very specific test that we lay out, and including the second prong of the test saying that the prior act must be closely related, the purpose of the rape shield law is to keep out evidence of the victim's past sexual conduct. And that whatever this incident was, if it was sexual, I think would clearly fall under that prohibition. The reason that I think the test has this closely related requirement is to keep that test.
You just kind of glossed over something, my review of the record. Do we know that the alleged, is it established within the record that the alleged prior incident was sexual in nature?
No, I don't believe it is. There is various descriptions of it, I guess, in the record.
I don't know if there are various descriptions so much as various interpretations that could come from the description that's in the record.
Well, yes, I think that's correct. I mean, if you're looking at the videotape, for example, I think is perhaps the best evidence that there is of whatever this prior incident was. We have the defendant's testimony, of course, but the circuit court found that not credible. But the tape not being in the record, and I don't know what's on it, but you have this at the post-conviction hearing, you have the assistant district attorney describing it one way, and you have Mr. Carter describing it another way, although, excuse me, and then his trial counsel also had some testimony about it where he says he reviewed the tape, and I think his trial counsel's testimony about the tape more strongly is closer to the state's description of the tape than Mr. Carter's, although trial counsel couldn't remember all the details of the tape.
Counsel, Justice Rogensack asked you what was your strongest argument, or at least I understood a question to be, what was your strongest argument under Polizzano?
Mm-hmm.
I wasn't clear about your response. You started with number one, the first prong of Polizzano, and I don't know if you meant that to be that is your strongest argument. The first prong is whether the event occurred.
Yes.
The second prong is it, I'm paraphrasing, reasonably related, close enough. The third is relevance, the fourth is necessity, etc. So what's your strong, if you have one, do you have a strongest? Are they all strong?
I think the strongest argument is that the defendant did not show that it clearly occurred, the first prong.
Okay, I don't think that's your strongest argument from my perception, because it is clear to me, at least the state's position, even at post-conviction, is that there was some kind of incident with the cousin, Aaron, previously. Am I wrong on that?
State's position at the previous incident was that she saw her cousin's penis, but that it was nothing sexual in nature, none of this, nothing like the defendant described happening.
Okay. So to me, that gets to whether or not it's similar in nature. The state's position, as I understand it, is that there was at post-conviction, is that there was a prior incident involving the cousin Aaron, that she came into wherever Aaron was, that he was masturbating.
No, that's not.
That's not. What was the state's position at post-conviction then?
The state's position at the post-conviction hearing was that the tape revealed, I believe it was in response to a question, had you ever seen another person's penis? She said, yes, I've seen my cousin's, and it was happened when they were at a house somewhere upstairs.
Big area, large area, she said. Okay.
Well, she said she didn't know if she was he was a man or a boy, but I think that's the statement.
I'm not talking about the area.
No.
I'm talking about the upstairs room.
Right.
Yeah, but you're right.
Okay, and then there is some
comment.
You know
what? I withdraw my question.
There is some description of the what she says next, and I think that's what's in dispute. There's this reference to she says they were making juice. The defendant says that means he was masturbating. The state's position was that they were making juice. That they were not. Well, I don't think it's related to his pants being down. I think it's later on they were playing house and they had something to drink. And there's a reference also in the record to a tea party. I mean, some other things that indicate that I think that making juice is not related to his pants being down. It sounds like, I mean, I don't know exactly what's on the tape, but that she saw his penis at some point, and they later did something else that involved making drinks.
Why don't we have the tape?
The tape's not in the record because it was not, it was never introduced at trial, and it was not included in the post-conviction proceedings as an exhibit. And based on the fact that it's not in the record and that the defendant was asking the Court of Appeals to reverse his conviction on that, on the basis of something in that tape, the tape has to be construed as supporting the Circuit Court's decision, and I don't think that the Court of Appeals paid deference to that either, although there is, I don't think they really took the tape into consideration either in making their decision.
Was the tape played in court?
It's not clear, and I don't know that it is. I don't think it would have been. It wasn't played during the trial. It was not played, as far as I know, at the post-conviction proceedings. It was never entered as an exhibit. I don't know that the post-conviction court ever viewed the tape, because if it did, I think it might be inappropriate that it did because it was never introduced as an exhibit. I think the court's decision, and to the extent it does address the tape, it talks about the victim's statements, which may be a reference to the tape, it might not be. It might be sort of what the defendant described her statements being. It's not entirely clear. But I think the court's analysis of whatever the victim said comes largely from the descriptions of this tape and by the defendant and the state and Mr. Carter's trial counsel.
Right. Didn't the trial court talk about assuming this could come in, or kind of took the defendant's version of what was on the tape and then made her rulings based on that?
I think it did. It's not entirely clear that the court made that decision, but there are some references to, well, if you look at the victim's statements, it's kind of a stretch to get it from to her acknowledge of pubic hair and erection and ejaculation. And so I think that the court was basing that decision on the party's description of the tape rather than that she viewed anything about it.
And that even assuming that what the defendant was saying was true regarding what the tape depicted, that the trial strategy employed by counsel rather than going after the 5-year-old was reasonable.
Correct. And I think if the court was making an assumption that it was a stretch that the victim's statement had knowledge of these other sexual characteristics, that's also a finding implicitly of no prejudice, because if it doesn't support the defendant's the claim he's trying to make, then it wouldn't come in and it wouldn't be couldn't have affected the outcome of his trial. And if I could just touch briefly on the differences between the previous incident and the incident at issue in this case. The previous incident, if the defendant's version of it is correct, it involves touching, whereas he was accused of forcing oral sex on the victim, or the victim to perform oral sex on him. The case law makes it pretty clear that these are two different kinds of sexual acts, and one's not probative of the other. And the defendant is also claiming that he needs to introduce this prior incident to show the victim's knowledge of erections and semen and pubic hair. But if you look at what the defendant said, I think in what he's related that the victim told him about the prior assault, I think it's a bit of a stretch to get to get to those conclusions as well. There's nothing that the victim said to him that says, my cousin had pubic hair, my cousin had an erection. It's just that, I helped him make juice, which the defendant, takes as a euphemism for masturbation, and there's some that she had to wash some white stuff off her hand, which I think is the assumption is that that's semen. But that's maybe perhaps the strongest point that the defendant has on those things, but nothing in what the victim supposedly told the defendant about this prior assault reveals that she had a knowledge of pubic hair or erections from the prior incident.
What was the defense at trial?
The defense at trial was that the victim
never
mother,
occurred, and the mother forced her to make this up.
Yeah, the mother
right?
put her up to it, yes.
So how would having an alternative source of knowledge affect that defense?
I think it could be construed as slightly inconsistent if you're claiming the victim had two different sources now of this knowledge that she shouldn't have. And if you're arguing that her mother gave her this information, told her about it, and told her what to say, then the fact that she has a different additional source for it is I think, somewhat inconsistent.
Counsel, do you think that the trial strategy, let's get back to my prior question. I had more luck on that one. The strategy employed here by trial counsel, do you think that was reasonable?
I do think it was reasonable, although I don't make that argument in my brief.
No, in fact, you say the contrary to your brief, I think. I think in your, especially your reply brief, you indicate reasonable. You say, while this, this is page 2 of your reply brief.
Yeah.
While the state acknowledges that Sargent's failure to investigate the prior assault or whether evidence of it was admissible might not have been a reasonable trial strategy.
It might not have been. We don't know because the defendant hasn't proven that his trial counsel acted deficiently. He hasn't come forward with the evidence showing what investigation his attorney should have conducted into this prior incident.
Well, isn't the real failure here of this attorney the failure to investigate? That you don't know what the attorney might have found about even other incidents had he investigated. And that he decided on his strategy of not raising this because he thought it would backfire on him without a full investigation. So by definition, how can it be reasonable that the attorney pick a strategy when he fails to investigate everything, or at least things that, about which he's making a strategy?
If you're saying that he couldn't make the decision without doing the investigation.
He could not reasonably make a strategy about the trial unless he knew what the evidence was about this or any other similar incident.
If he
just couldn't do it because he didn't know. Isn't that what Thiel says?
That's what the Court of Appeals concluded. But I mean, if he decided he just never wanted to go down that road in the first place, and even if he had done a full investigation and found that this evidence might be admissible, if he decided then, I mean, maybe that's sufficient performance. But then
he went down the road, he got all the evidence that was available to him at that time, which might not have been everything, because you just never know where everything
is. Mean,
then he looks at the evidence, he looks at Pulisano, and he says, I'm not going to bring this in, even if there's a good shot that it will be admitted, because I think it will backfire. I talk to my client agrees with my strategy, I'm not bringing it in. That's, I think, effective counsel. But when the counsel doesn't bother to find out what the real facts are, other than a statement by the client, and he may have had trouble finding out what the real facts are because no one may have talked to him or an investigator, but if he doesn't know what the facts are, he can't, and he hasn't really carefully looked at Pulisano, then how can he make a reasonable strategy? That's my point.
I think I agree with that statement, that he can't. And
but did he argue that at trial or at the post-conviction remedies, the argument I just made?
Did the
defense,
the trial,
defense counsel?
The trial attorney said that was his strategy. He said that he was aware of this incident, although there's some dispute, quite a bit of dispute actually, how much the defendant told his trial counsel about this prior incident. Trial counsel testified that the defendant never gave him any particulars about the case as compared to what he came up with in his post-conviction testimony. Yeah, he said that was his strategy, to not introduce this evidence.
Okay. Other questions? Well then, thank you, Mr. O'Neill. You have 5 minutes in rebuttal. Mr. Orszlewski, representing Michael Carter.
To please the court, I'm John Boschalewski, representing Michael James Carter. A defense attorney had a client. The client was accused by basically his girlfriend's child of sexual assault, and the client denies it. So we have an accusing child, we have a denying defendant, and there's no physical evidence tipping the scales either way. There's no DNA, there's no medical evidence. Whenever an attorney encounters a situation on the defense side, they have to, that I believe, as a matter of reasonable strategy, you have to address definitely one and sometimes two questions. The first question that any defense attorney has to be prepared to deal with is, well, If these allegations are false, why would this accuser make a false allegation? And this question, trial counsel did address. He brought up how Mr. Carter and the girl's mother, Denise, were in a relationship that was falling apart, that was filled with arguments. There were arguments over money. There were arguments over drug use. It was a tumultuous relationship out of which a false allegation could have grown. But there's a second question.
Help me out with that part. How does an alternative source of knowledge of a child bolster the argument that the mom forced her to make this up?
I, first of all, would have to back off with the statement that the mom forced the girl to make it up.
What was the defense?
The defense was that out of this tumultuous relationship, the scenario is this relationship lasted 6-7 months at least at the time that the two were in Milwaukee. I think it predated that. I'm talking about Mr. Carter and the mother, who is Denise. And 2-3 weeks after Mr. Carter's out of the household is when this allegation came up, and the child had seen and the mother had experienced all these arguments and these fights, which were pretty much agreed to by both Mr. Carter and Denise in their testimony. It was a rocky situation that led to a false allegation. There's no direct evidence that the child concocted it herself as opposed to the mother putting it in her head, but
so
that's the source of it.
The defense urged the jury to accept what conclusion? I'm getting falsely accused here, and the reason why is they're mad at me because we're breaking up.
Right.
Okay.
It's more
the
of a
defense
motivation.
Didn't offer anything else, like the mother's upset and you know is forcing this child to do this, or it was the child on her own who came up with this. I'm trying to figure out how it bolsters that defense to say this child knows what semen is. It seems to me that almost might work against that defense. Because his defense is, hey, not me. I didn't have anything to do with this. They're making this up. But how does it help him to say they're making this up? And by the way, the reason why she knows about semen is from this other person.
Well, the defense, I think, is he didn't do it.
Right, I know.
And the motivation supporting that defense is there was a tumultuous relationship that could cause the child or the mother or both to dislike him and make a false allegation.
Why, under Polizano, would a trial court judge allow this evidence to come in? I've not seen the connection between the defense and the necessity of this coming in and the similarity between these two allegations.
Well, first off, the allegation comes from the child. Okay.
Yeah, but every time you have an allegation, you don't get to go into a sexual assault victim's past and how they might know about sex. In fact, that's exactly what Polizano says you can't do. You've got to really thread the needle to get that evidence in. So you got to figure out as a judge, how does it come in, why does it come in, and how does this? Where's the interplay with the defense theory so that it makes sense and we can explain to the jury why this evidence is coming in. So that's why I'm asking you, help me out. Help me figure out what the theory is as to how this bolsters the defense.
Well, any jury is going to wonder, this is a 5-year-old child. How does this 5-year-old child know, for example, what an erection is? Now, the 5-year-old child never in the testimony or anywhere else that I know of uses the word erection. In fact, the officer's testimony from the officer that took the statement from the child said she had some kind of a toy or a doll that she held over her vaginal area in an erect position to demonstrate what an erection is. A jury seeing this or hearing about this would know, though, there's a 5-year-old child describing an erection. And if the only thing the jury knows is this child says that Mr. Carter did these things to her, and here she is describing an erection, she must know. She must have personal experience, and that experience, from what the jury hears, could only come from Mr. Carter. If no alternate source of knowledge is offered, no matter how powerful the motivation is from this crumbling relationship to fabricate something, if the jury hears that a 5-year-old knows what an erection is, knows what semen is, knows about pubic hair, what conclusion does the jury draw other than this child experienced those things, and the only thing they'll hear about is She experienced them with Mr. Carter.
Was that argument made by the state at trial?
Certainly. It's in the closing argument, and I believe I quoted in my brief that each one of those factors was addressed. How could this child be lying? She knows about these things. She must be telling the truth because there's no alternate explanation for her knowing about semen, ejaculation.
So it's your position that the importance of the prior knowledge or the prior incident, that information is not incompatible with the defense asserted, but rather without it, it leaves the defense of motive asserted incomplete.
The defense is that he didn't do it.
He didn't
the
do it.
The motive for the false allegation is these arguments that the couple have.
But how did this five-year-old know it?
Precisely. If you cannot, as defense attorney, explain how a five-year-old can talk about these things in five-year-old terms, albeit, then the strength of the motivation, the strength of the I didn't do it denial is meaningless, especially in a case like this where the allegation is very vague as to time. There's a 6 or 7 month period alleged, sometime during which this child says something happened. So it gets a little tricky here because as the state has pointed out.
Acknowledge that he didn't know about Polizano. Is that correct?
That was his testimony. And if you look at not just what happened in the post-conviction hearing, but what happened at the beginning of the trial, I think it's clear reading the statements there that the defense counsel speaks right up and says, I just want to state, I didn't put this in my motions in limine, but I'm going to say it now, I know about a prior sexual incident involving this child, and I'm not going to use it, and my three reasons are that, first of all, that the DA is going to object, and second, I don't want to arouse, I don't remember the exact order, second was he didn't want to arouse sympathy for the child, and third, he didn't think it was
relevant.
And no mention was made of Polizano by name or by reference that, you know, I looked at cases and that based on those, it's my conclusion. And I think then when it came to the post-conviction hearing, trial counsel conceded, no, I've never looked at Polizano. So he made his decision to not pursue this without doing any research. He was aware of the facts. He had the videotape of the child, he had what his client told him, and he didn't seek to use either of those or to cross-examine the child with regard to those. In fact, he took that off the table before the first witness was called. And I do not believe that that was a reasonable trial strategy, because by taking that off the table, he took away any way to explain to the jury how a five-year-old could know about sexual matters.
Did you handle the post-conviction hearing?
I beg your pardon?
Did you handle the post-conviction
hearing? I did.
Okay, and what did you say about Polizano?
What did I
say? How did you use Polizano?
I argued both in my written motion and in oral argument that Polizano would allow admission of the prior incident because it would show how this child had an experience that gave her knowledge of penises and erections and semen and pubic hair. And that I went through the five-part test in my written motion. I believe that I'd established each of those five aspects of it.
How did you, your opposing counsel talks about the prior act clearly occurred. How did you establish that?
Well, the source of the prior act is the same as the information. Everything we know about this prior act ultimately comes from five-year-old Cassandra. Everything we know about the allegation that supports the charge ultimately comes from the five-year-old Cassandra. Like, as I said early on in my remarks, there's no physical evidence, there's no other witness. They both come from that same source. They're both on that same videotape that was discussed and that trial counsel testified about at the post-conviction hearing. Well, and my client testified to an incident separate from that where he learned from Cassandra about the incident after Cassandra followed him to the bathroom door and then talked to him about making juice.
Why was that videotape never introduced?
Every time I touch this file, I regret not introducing it. I can offer no good reason. I can only tell you my mindset on this was there wasn't a lot of dispute about what was on that videotape. The trial counsel testified to what he remembered about it. He wasn't real clear in his recollection, but when I led him through what I saw to be on it, he agreed with my characterizations. The district attorney who provided me with that videotape, I didn't think was going to dispute what was on it. Ultimately, in argument, though, she did dispute one aspect of it, which is the inference to be drawn from the five-year-old's phrase, making juice. And I heard it for the first time in her closing argument that this was some kind of reference to a beverage and not to an ejaculation, which surprised me.
Counsel, so you were the attorney at the Mockner hearing?
I was, and I did not enter that.
Isn't this really just a request for another Mockner hearing?
I never requested a remand. That was the Court of Appeals sua sponte deciding to return this. Mr. O'Neill likewise never asked for any type of remand. This was a remedy granted so far by the Court of Appeals that neither side asked for. Would it be just another Mockner hearing? Well, it would be a chance to supplement the record because the Court of Appeals, I think, wanted more. I also quoted a case, I believe it's called Rolowinski, in my brief. And I'm only speculating why the Court of Appeals did what they did, but I think one possibility is they could have granted a new trial because I believe I established both prongs of under Strickland. And they didn't want to do that because they thought there was more evidence that could be put on the record, and in particular, the videotape, which I, to this day, and every day since the Court of Appeals decision, and perhaps before that, I've regretted not putting it in the record, but it's not there. We have the descriptions of it.
Well, before us, are you asking us to affirm the Court of Appeals or just to reverse the Circuit Court's decision on the Mockner hearing, or what are you asking exactly?
I'm asking this court to reverse the Court of Appeals and grant a new trial. And if the court is not willing to do that, I also am arguing in the alternative then that this should be remanded for further proceedings so that the tape can be put into evidence. I've also considered seriously, well, what would go in at another hearing? My client's already testified. I would put the tape in, but that's already been testified about. I don't expect that to be a huge change. And I can tell the court candidly, I considered when having this Mockner hearing whether I should simply subpoena the uncooperative Cassandra and her mother. And I didn't, because then I wouldn't know what to expect from them. They weren't cooperating beforehand with trial counsel, and I didn't do that. But if the Court of Appeals or this court wants a complete record, what does everybody say about this prior incident so that we can evaluate it more fully, I'd be happy to put everything I can into it if the court wants that.
Counsel, aren't you really just asking that we reverse Polizano? How can you get around the facts of Polizano where there the defendant wanted to introduce evidence of a prior sexual assault for the limited purpose of proving an alternate source for sexual knowledge, and that was with children? Aren't you saying if it's a child, it's always going to be important to introduce evidence of how they got the knowledge? So really, the rape shield law doesn't apply when you have a child who's allegedly sexually assaulted. I don't see how we can do what you're asking about overturning Polizano and the rape shield law.
Well, every case is different on its facts. If a child, for example, claims that someone simply vaginally touched her, well, the child knows her own body, and a five-year-old simply saying that that happened doesn't seem to call for any unusual sophistication. But when a child talks about erections or ejaculations, if there's an alternate explanation for how a child acquired such knowledge, it may be essential to the defense.
I understand your position to be, counsel, that you're relying on Polzano, that if there had been investigation or further appropriate performance and not deficient performance, there would have been further investigation. You would have been able to establish the five prongs of Polzano, and maybe you can even establish on the record that exists the five prongs of Polzano. That's what you're trying to argue here, that there would have been an exception because the five prongs upon which you rely could be shown. That's what I thought your argument was.
Right. I think the key thing about Polzano, the key distinction when you talk about particularly the second prong, whether the prior incident closely resembles the current allegations, really comes down to can the prior incident explain the knowledge? And in some cases it can, and in some cases it can't. There's a case, the Dunlop case that the state relies on very heavily, goes through a number of other cases and discusses that closely resembling factor, the second Polzano criteria. And there's a case in there where a child was acting out and masturbating, and the court simply found in that case that has didn't prove what the defendant was trying to prove for his defense. But I believe an adequate defense would require explanations of the three things that I've mentioned too many times already: semen, ejaculation, pubic hair. A fourth thing would be necessary, but it's already in the record, and that is oral sex, because the prior incident was not an oral sex incident by any information I've seen. The current allegation is one of mouth-to-penis sex. How does the child know about that? I don't know. But when the police officer testified to her statement, the child described knowing about oral sex, knowing that she needed to keep her mouth shut, and the officer could not extract from this child what the basis of that prior knowledge was. It's already in the record. It's already part of the evidence in this case. So that's sort of the fourth factual prong to establish how a five-year-old child could give the specifics to make her allegation.
Well, even if you found that the performance of the trial defense counsel was deficient, was it prejudicial? Does it undermine confidence in the verdict? It's one way of putting it. Others might say, would a jury have found him not guilty or acquitted him? Divided in a mistrial.
Well, I think the Strickland standards stated in various ways, but it's usually in terms of a reasonable probability of a different result. Not would there be an automatic guaranteed acquittal.
You can use any standard you like.
Okay.
Within reason.
I think that...
Is it prejudicial?
It's prejudicial because there was no explanation for how this five-year-old child knew about these sexual matters. Without that...
Well, this was a he said, she said, wasn't it?
Exactly.
All right. And so you think this would have attacked the child's credibility significantly, sufficiently?
It would have allowed the jury to understand how a child could make an allegation like this, other than learning it because what Mr. Carter was accused of is exactly what happened. Because, of course, that's the state's explanation for how she knew about erections and semen, etc. If there's an alternate explanation of a prior incident where the child knew of these things, then it makes plausible that she fabricated the allegations. That plausibility is absent without the alternative explanation, and trial counsel's failure to pursue that explanation to be able to show the jury the alternate source of knowledge is within the defense.
To get a new trial, does this court have to find, therefore, that there was prejudice?
To grant me a new trial? Absolutely. That's the second prong of Strickland.
So we'd have to first find that it was below the par, that the representation was deficient, and secondly, that it was prejudicial, or just find prejudicial.
Correct. And I, as I walked in this courtroom today, was not quite sure to what degree the deficient performance prong was even at issue, since, as this court pointed out in questioning to Mr. O'Neill, there was a virtual concession that not pursuing this was not reasonable. I guess how it could be unreasonable but not amount to deficient performance is something I can't quite square. But
well, I think you can read this transcript as saying that that no prejudice was established. The burden is on you, right?
The burden is on the defense to establish prejudice. Are you referring now to the circuit court's comments?
Yes.
My reading of the circuit court's decision is that Judge McMahon clearly found the trial counsel's strategy to be reasonable. And I think the Court of Appeals clearly disagreed with it and reversed on that aspect. With regard to what the trial court said about prejudice, I don't find that so clear. There are no clear factual findings as to prejudice. I think Judge McMahon was skeptical of Mr. Carter's testimony. I think Judge McMahon said she was skeptical of whether Pulitzano could be met, but she didn't go through, she never even enumerated the five factors of Pulitzano. So I think it's fair to say that the circuit court made no prejudice analysis, since I have trouble seeing how that could be done without reviewing whether it's admissible under Pulitzano. So I think, and I've also struggled with, why did the Court of Appeals remand? And I think that on the face of the decision, they want a better factual record. But I also think they may have taken the position, at least implicitly, that why should the Court of Appeals make the first full fleshed-out findings as to prejudice when the circuit court failed to do so, and failed to do so specifically with regard to whether or not the prior incident's admissible or not under Pulitzano.
What, if any, import do we give to the determination of the post-conviction court and with regard to the testimony offered by your client? My recollection is that she found your client's testimony incredible. Am I right or wrong?
She did, but when she specifically went into what parts she thought were incredible, it wasn't so much with whether or not some prior act happened or if it happened exactly as he spelled it out, except when you get to the point where Mr. Carter wasn't quite sure of the aftermath. Were the police called? Well, they never contacted him. He thought they were involved, but and I believe that something that I may have put in the post-conviction motion as an offer of proof deviated slightly from how it came out at the post-conviction motion hearing regarding the aftermath and police involvement or non-involvement and what he knew about it. And that she gleaned onto as a discrepancy, and from that made more general findings of that she didn't want to accept his testimony.
That's the way I read it, exactly as you're describing, that the judge focused on a particular thing, that is the discrepancy, if you will, between the motion filed and the testimony with regard to whether or not law enforcement had been contacted regarding the prior incident.
Correct.
And that, based on that, she extrapolated, now I'm using my term, that he's not to be believed, that it's in a more general sense that his testimony was incredible. That's the way I interpreted that passage from the transcript.
I took Judge McMahon to be making going to the very specific fact and then making a broader conclusion about credibility, but again, not ever explicitly saying, I therefore find that the prior incident never occurred, or I therefore find that it wasn't
usually similar,
or any of
those things. I think she just thought
he was a
liar. You know, she didn't use that term, but, you know, what you're saying isn't truthful here.
Correct.
That's the way I read it.
And now, Pulizzano is normally something that should be invoked in pretrial motions, or in motions in limine, and what's required then is an offer of proof, and a decision's made based on that. And then there's the testimony in post-conviction. Well, I made my offer of proof written in a written form in my post-conviction motion and then offered the testimony. But Pulizzano, by its own words, requires an offer of proof. And certainly my client's testimony satisfies it to that degree.
Counselor, if we leave in place the circuit court's finding that your client was not credible, then that goes to opposing counsel's argument under Pulizzano that he thinks is the strongest argument, that the prior act was not a prior sexual act. If you didn't, and I guess you didn't subpoena the victim, so unless you have a totally new hearing, I don't see how you can ever meet that initial test under Pulizzano that the prior sexual act clearly occurred.
Well, what we have in this record is that the child referred to making juice with Aaron while his pants were down. And
well, you have that testimony from your client, correct?
Right, and I believe I have to check if what specific trial counsel's testimony was about that. The district attorney, of course, who was in court, never disputed until closing arguments when what she disputed wasn't the facts of the words. What she disputed was, well, what does making juice mean? Her inference is it refers to beverages and not to ejaculation. And I think that if you want any testimony subject to an inference of what the words mean, I don't think that's reasonable under the circumstances, talking about beverages with Aaron's pants being down. That to say that, you know, Aaron was standing around with his pants down.
Well, if Aaron was going to
the
bathroom, his pants were down. I mean, kids are not particularly modest generally. If they need to go to the bathroom and they're playing with another kid, they just walk in and go. I mean, it's not like they shut the door generally. I mean, I don't know if you have children, but I have children and grandchildren, and none of them were ever very modest. So
I could reflect.
Right. So young children just tend not to make a big deal out of body parts. I think adults make big deals out of body parts, but generally little kids.
Perhaps so, but nothing in what's in the record regarding this tape talks about Aaron being in the bathroom or going to the bathroom.
Was there anything that prevented you from subpoenaing Aaron to the Mockner hearing? Subpoenaing the little girl, was it Sandra? Yeah, the Mockner hearing.
The decision not to subpoena her was that she'd not been cooperative with trial counsel and that she had, I'm in Milwaukee, this is a Milwaukee case, and my best information was she and her mother moved back to Adams County. Those were my two factors, and I knew what I had in the tape, I knew what I had in my client's testimony. Bringing Cassandra or her mother would have been opening a door without knowing what's on the other side for me.
You ever go talk to Aaron? Isn't that the name of the nephew? No. Okay. All right. Thank you.
I see my time is up. Are there any further questions?
Justice Prosser?
When did this alleged sexual assault occur?
The one alleged against Mr. Carter?
Yeah.
It was alleged to have occurred while living at a place called Donna Court over a 7-month period. I believe it's 7 months in the complaint and information. But no, it's not described with any further specificity than having occurred sometime over a 6 or 7 month period. And that period was defined by the length of time that Mr. Carter and Cassandra and Cassandra's mother resided at a particular residence in Milwaukee.
Did Mr. Carter testify that he told Cassandra's mother about the incident in the bathroom? His incident in the bathroom?
Well, his incident in the bathroom, yeah.
Before this alleged sexual assault took place?
I believe his testimony was that he told Cassandra's mother immediately after learning of it, and that this all happened up in Adams County before the time span of the alleged offense.
So that, are you alleging that the mother had been told about the incident with Mr. Carter and could have used that information against Mr. Carter after they split up?
I'm a little confused as to, are you referring to the incident with Mr. Carter being in the bathroom and...
Yeah. You've never talked with Cassandra's mother?
I have not.
You sent an investigator to, well, strike that. Trial counsel testified he'd sent an investigator to talk with her and that she declined.
It seems to me, aren't you asking us to accept your spin on a whole lot of facts without investigation?
I wasn't aware I was giving anything a particular spin other than the interpretation of the word making juice or the phrase making juice. That I think the trial court prosecutor and I disagreed on. But beyond that, what we have here is there was an incident. Trial counsel knew of it at the beginning of the trial, and he said, I'm not going to use it. And he testified about it at the post-conviction hearing. He knew about it. His client told him about it. He saw it on the video. The incident is what it is. As I said early on in my remarks, the origin of all of this, the prior incident and the allegations of which Mr. Carter now stands convicted, all originate out of Cassandra's, 5-year-old Cassandra's mom.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you to both. I'm sorry, Mr. O'Neill, you have 5 minutes in rebuttal. I nearly cut you off. I apologize.
Thank you, Your Honor. It seems to me that the issue, perhaps not in this case of the way the issues have been framed in this court, but the sort of important thing to determine in this case is what happened in this prior incident. And I don't know what happened in this prior incident. I don't think the Court of Appeals knew what happened in this prior incident. The Circuit Court didn't know what happened in this prior incident. I don't know that this court can figure out what happened in this prior incident. It seems to me that the easiest way to figure out what happened would have been to put first the videotape in the record. That would have gone a long way to clearing up, well, obviously what's on the videotape, but whatever Cassandra said about this prior incident. It would have been also a great way to clear up whatever this prior incident was by subpoenaing Cassandra or her mother or both of them, both who the defendant claims have knowledge of this prior incident. There could have been relatively few quick questions to them about what happened, and it would have been very easy to figure out what this prior incident, whatever happened during it. Unfortunately, none of that's in the record. And the Court of Appeals sent this case back, I think, to allow the defendant to make that record. The problem the state has with that is that he could have done this before he appealed his decision. Yes. The Court of Appeals, not exactly sure. I mean, the Court of Appeals obviously has authority to remand for additional, you know, if for example, the Court of Appeals wanted a better explanation of prejudice from the prejudice determination by the Circuit Court, it could have sent it back and said, give us a better explanation of what you were doing. But that's not what happened here. The Court of Appeals decided to give the defendant a new Mockner hearing. And under these circumstances, I don't believe that he's entitled to correct what he should have done in the first place. The only other thing I wanted to mention was the defendant has asked for a reversal as opposed to affirming the Court of Appeals remand. He, as I pointed out in my reply brief, can't make this argument in this court because he did not petition for review from this Court of Appeals decision remanding. And again, I would urge this court, even if overlooking the failure to petition for review, the court could not reverse unless there has been a showing that the defendant had satisfied both prongs of Strickland versus Washington. And as I've argued today, that it's just he has not made that showing. And I'd ask this court to reverse the decision of the Court of Appeals, and reinstate the judgment of conviction or denying the defendant's motion for post-conviction relief.
Did the defendant testify at the trial?
He did.
And at the Mockner hearing?
Yes. Is there any further questions? Thank you.
Not counsel. Thank you.
Thank you.
And thank you, not only Mr. O'Neill, but Mr. Wasilewski, for your arguments today on yet another ineffective assistance of counsel case in a different setting. That concludes our hearing on 08 AP 1185 CR, State versus Michael J. Carter. The court is recessed until the next oral argument, which is later in the month of November. The court will meet in conference at 3:10.